Greetings once again, Tacoma. John Doherty here for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate. Maybe just as dear to us as Pacific Northwesterners as Mount Rainier is Puget Sound. What a beautiful body of water, really close to unique in the world. We're so blessed to have it. But the reality is we could be taking a lot better care of it. Climate change is a part of that. Toxicity is a part of it. One of the premier organizations concerned about the quality of our water in the Puget Sound is the Puget Sound Keepers Alliance. We're going to be talking to their executive director today. So here we go. We're very fortunate to have Chris Rilling with us today. He's the executive director of the Puget Sound Keeper Alliance. Chris is intimately involved with the health of the Puget Sound, what we might call more correctly the Salish Sea, although the Puget Sound is the southern part of that. So, Chris, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, John. It's good to be with you.
So let's just start off. Who's Chris Rilling? How come you're the executive director of the Puget Sound Keeper Alliance?
Well, that's a good question, John. I've been executive director for about 8 months now. I joined Puget Sound Keeper last September. They were looking for a new executive director. The previous executive director left the organization to work for the National Waterkeeper Organization. I guess the reason I was selected was because of my background. I grew up in California, have a degree in marine biology, and as soon as I graduated from Humboldt State University, I went fishing in Alaska. And I fished there for 10 years, from the early 80s to the early 90s, in Prince William Sound, doing commercial salmon, herring, and halibut fishing. First as a crew member on boats and eventually running my own boats. I didn't own the boat. It was my brother's boat, but I ran a commercial seine operating boat. And I was actually in Prince William Sound for the oil spill in 1989, and I was captain of one of the first boats to respond to that spill. One of the first commercial fishing boats to respond to that spill, and was responsible for setting up oil absorbent and deflection booms in the southern part of Prince William Sound to protect some of the salmon hatcheries. Well, unfortunately, that entire experience of working and fishing in Prince William Sound came to an end after the spill. It took a few years, but the herring fishery that we were completely dependent on collapsed entirely in 1992 and then fully in 1993. And I decided to go back to graduate school. So I went to back to school to study fishery science and fishery ecology at the University of Maryland, Chesapeake Biological Laboratory. Graduated with a master's degree. And a few years after that, began working for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I spent essentially the rest of my career with them, almost 20 years. In various capacities, working both for the Office of Ocean and Coastal Resource Management, doing coastal zone management work, and then transferring and working, spending the last two-thirds of my career with NOAA, working with NOAA Fisheries, helping to write environmental impact statements and fishery management plans for various stocks in the Atlantic Ocean. And then I moved to Seattle in 2013 to become what eventually turned into a director position for one of the divisions at the Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Seattle. I retired from NOAA in 2018, having spent almost 20 years with them. I was just looking for a change. I really enjoyed my career with NOAA. It's a great organization to work for. And but, you know, I was ready for a change. And so I took a year off and then traveled some with my wife in Europe, had a great time. And got a little restless and wanted to begin work again. And when I saw this opportunity to become involved in local issues in Puget Sound, I was really excited about that opportunity. So I applied and was fortunate enough to be selected as executive director.
Well, that's an awesome background in it. And it seems like you're just the guy for the job. So one of the things I'm hearing is a real mix of hands-on with fisheries and the ocean. And especially the spill up in Alaska, pretty amazing experience in terms of turning your head towards the ecological side of it. I'm just wondering, was it a little weird being a marine biologist and being a fisherman at the same time?
It wasn't. I mean, there's no better way to get connected and really experience firsthand the marine environment than to be a commercial fisherman, as they will tell you. You know, they're really, in many cases, the leading conservationists for fish stocks. They're intimately involved in helping to set the to establish the fishery management plans for those stocks, and then obviously to implement and adhere to those regulations. So, no, I think it just provided an additional insight into some of the biological characteristics of the species that we were fishing for. And, you know, the stocks in Prince William Sound were being sustainably managed. They were doing very well. All of the salmon stocks and the herring stock was doing exceptionally well. So I didn't have any misgivings about it. I felt very much in tune with the marine environment, even as a commercial fisherman. I think a lot of commercial fishermen will share that perspective and that feeling.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to hear. I would say that my perspective, and perhaps an inaccurate perspective, is that fishermen are just going to fish all the fish until they're all gone, and then we'll just have to deal with it. I mean, isn't it true that fisheries in various parts of the world are really under a lot of stress?
Yes. So globally, our fish stocks are doing very poorly. And that's in part because they're not well managed. You know, a lot of the coastal stocks around the world have been depleted. And so these fishing fleets from various countries have adopted and gone to the high seas to begin exploiting species there over the last 20 to 30 years that hadn't previously been exploited. And a lot of those are now in trouble as well. So you're right. I mean, there is sort of this global demand for fish as protein that's driving this, the construction of an overcapitalization, I believe, of the fishing fleets of the world. That's not been the case in the United States. You know, we have the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. We have fishery management councils in each of the regions of the U.S. that oversee all of our domestic stocks. And that's a science-based process where we look at the numbers, we collect data through our observer programs and other means to have a robust stock assessment done for each of those stocks. And if they are in trouble, to have a rebuilding plan in place to ensure that they will eventually be sustainably managed or are in the process of being sustainably managed. So I've always been very proud of the fishery management approach in the U.S. I think it's really one of the leading examples, along with some of our other environmental laws, of how effective we've been at managing our natural resources.
Well, it's really good to hear. And of course, it's always wonderful to hear politically that we're paying attention to the science, because it seems like science has kind of fallen out of popularity politically these days. I was in Liberia in Africa on a consulting contract, and one of the things I learned there was that there were Korean fishing boats fishing in the Liberian waters, and of course the Liberians didn't have the financial resources to police their own waters, so the Koreans were just coming in there and taking whatever they could take. No slam against the Koreans in particular. I think it's probably a pretty common practice around the world. Would that be the case, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I was referring to when I was mentioning that there are many countries around the world that have developed these high seas fishing fleets that really go all over the world to fish. And that's the example you gave is one I'm familiar with, of going off the coast of Africa, because that's where a lot of the tuna stocks are. And, you know, they hadn't been exploited yet. And so a lot of the international fishing fleets ended up focused in that area. So, yeah, that is a problem. And, you know, it's because of lack of strong management entities in some of those areas, both domestic and international, and also enforcement. You know, there's really no enforcement to speak of on the high seas. It's essentially unregulated. And that has created a giant loophole for many different countries to exploit resources beyond their capacity.
Yep, I get that. So one of the things we're seeing environmentally, and this program is called Climate Talk, so we are interested in climate. I'm just going to use climate metaphorically here for a second, and that is that it is just one planet, and everything sooner or later is connected. And it seems like I'm glad that we're somewhat of a city on a hill in terms of fisheries here in the United States, but significant problems around the world. And so that's certainly a long-term worry. Well, we've wandered a little bit from Puget Sound all the way to the coast of Africa. So let's get back over to the Puget Sound here. And would you mind just giving us an overview of what Puget Sound Keepers is all about?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. So we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization whose mission is to preserve and protect the waters of Puget Sound. You may be familiar with the Waterkeeper Alliance. They're a national organization, actually international at this point. The Waterkeeper organization was founded in the early 80s on the Hudson River by a group of commercial fishermen who wanted to restore water quality and restore some of the depleted fish stocks on the Hudson River. So they formed their own monitoring and patrolling unit that they called a Waterkeeper organization to keep an eye on the water and to monitor for pollution and illegal discharges that might be happening in the river, all in an effort to restore the Hudson River. So that was sort of the beginning of the Waterkeeper movement in the U.S. and the world. And since then, it's grown. We have about 350, I believe now, Waterkeeper organizations around the globe. Puget Soundkeeper Alliance was the sixth Waterkeeper organization formed in the U.S., and we were formed in 1984. So we've been around a long time. Our focus is on water quality, both in the tributaries, rivers, streams flowing into Puget Sound, as well as the Puget Sound itself. And we are empowered by the Clean Water Act. So the Clean Water Act requires government to ensure that water quality standards are being met in all of our rivers and streams across the state. And that permits are required for any discharges of from industrial facilities, for instance, as you might see on the Duwamish River. And that is what we monitor as well. So the Department of Ecology in the state of Washington is charged with issuing the permits for industrial industries. That's a double statement there, but for industries in Washington. And they're also the ones responsible for monitoring and enforcing those permit requirements. But we also play a role in that. And under the Clean Water Act, there's what's referred to as a citizen suit provision, which allows citizens or groups such as ourselves, represented by our members, to take legal action against polluters. And so that's a key part of our mission, is both monitoring and enforcement of the Clean Water Act in Washington State. And we do that by both being out on the water. So we, just like the folks on the Hudson River did way back in the early 80s, we've been doing that for many, many decades, patrolling the water either on kayaks or using boats with volunteers or staff to look for sources of pollution that might be coming into our local water bodies and rivers, streams, and ultimately Puget Sound. So we work a lot with volunteers. We take volunteers out on our kayak patrols or boat patrols. And we're always on the lookout for marine debris. If we're out patrolling, we'll be doing pickups and cleanups at the same time. We also have directed efforts where we engage volunteers to do beach cleanups with us in various locations around Puget Sound. So it's all geared at maintaining water quality, preserving and protecting the waters of Puget Sound. We also get involved in with the legislature. So we have a policy and civic engagement arm where we work with communities. We work with ecology, obviously, to try and strengthen some of those permits that I mentioned originally that are issued to municipalities and companies that are discharging from their facilities. We work to strengthen those and have been doing that for many decades now. We also get involved with legislative efforts, for instance, to reduce the use of plastics. Last year, we helped co-sponsor legislation that banned the use of single-use plastic bags throughout the state. A lot of municipalities have been doing that on their own individually, but this was the first statewide ban that went into effect this past March after the legislative session. So that's another component. And then, of course, we're involved in education and outreach. So we work with local community groups. We're on a lot of different coalitions that are all focused on either restoring or protecting the habitat and Puget Sound itself. We have youth groups that we work with. We do a lot of stream monitoring and pollution monitoring. We have a pollution hotline where people can report to us if they're witnessing, seeing any pollution in our local waters, and then we'll follow up on that or make sure that the appropriate authorities are notified about that. So it's kind of a broad range of efforts that we engage in, beginning with monitoring enforcement. That's sort of the key. We will hold big polluters accountable under the Clean Water Act. We've taken quite a few to court over the years, and we've had a lot of successful wins against some polluters around the Washington state area and Puget Sound area. But we also think it's really important to get the communities involved in some of the monitoring and patrolling work that we do. So we have a fairly robust program of getting volunteers out on the water and doing beach cleanups.
Well, it's amazing all the different aspects of your organization and what you're taking on. I'll thank you later on again, but thank you for all your organization is doing. Just a little personal thing here. I'm a boater myself. I've been boating in the Salish Sea since the 80s. And I'm just wondering, when you do the patrols, you do those on boats sometimes. Are those your own vessels or are those private vessels that do those patrols?
We currently lease a vessel that we keep at Elliott Bay Marina. That's our powered vessel. And under normal circumstances, of course, now we're in the COVID pandemic, so we've cut back. We've essentially halted all of our volunteer engagements and patrols for the time being because of the social distancing requirements. But under normal conditions, we'd be out on boat patrols every other week. We'd be doing kayak patrols every week with volunteers. We lease a vessel, as I mentioned, that we more in Elliott Bay Marina, and we'll do a lot of patrols along Elliott Bay, along the Seattle waterfront, and then we do a lot of patrols up the Duwamish River because that's such a heavily industrialized area, and there are a lot of outfalls there and a lot of permittees that we'd like to keep an eye on to make sure they're staying in compliance with the clean water laws.
Understood. So one of the things I'm wondering about, of course, I'm talking to you from Tacoma. And are you guys active in Commencement Bay and the waterways and the tide flats?
Yes, we are actually. We don't get down there all the time, but when we hear about potential sources of pollution, and there are many ways to go about this, actually, the permits that I mentioned that are issued by the Department of Ecology fall under the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, NPDES permitting system. And any companies that have those permits, one of the requirements of the permit is to monitor the discharge and to track it for certain pollutants and to post that information on publicly available websites. So that's another way that we track what the discharges are that are coming from different industrial polluters along our waterways. So we can do it both that way electronically, but we can also do it by getting out on the water. Sometimes we'll get tips from locals, or by doing our research online, we'll find that there might be some illegal discharges occurring. And at that point, we might gear up to go do an actual patrol. And that could include anywhere in Puget Sound. So yeah, we can trailer a boat down to Commencement Bay or north into other areas to do our patrols. But one of the exciting new developments recently is that we are expanding our Puget Sound Keeper Alliance to include an affiliate in South Puget Sound. It's a group referred to as the Deschutes Estuary Restoration Team. And they are going to be taking on some of the waterkeeper roles and responsibilities as an affiliate of ours here in the coming months. So that's another means of trying to monitor different areas of Puget Sound is by getting other groups involved. There's also another waterkeeper entity in the north part of Puget Sound. They operate out of Bellingham, and it's part of Resources for Sustainable Communities. That's a nonprofit, and they have a program that they refer to as the North Sound Baykeeper Program. And they do the same thing we do, but they're doing that in the northern part of Puget Sound. And we collaborate with both those groups to do pollution patrols, pollution monitoring, outreach and education, and to engage in stewardship activities to preserve Puget Sound. So we have a pretty broad reach, and we're always looking to expand that reach. And by the way, there are other waterkeeper organizations in the state of Washington. There's a Columbia River Keeper, there's a Spokane River Keeper, there's a Twin Harbors Bay Keeper, and I think, I don't know if I missed any others, but so the waterkeeper organizations are not only in Puget Sound, they're also on various water bodies throughout Washington State.
So let's say an ordinary kayaker is kayaking around the Theophos Waterway or something down here in Tacoma, and they see some discharge somewhere. How would they know whether that was something that should be of concern or that's just normal runoff from a storm drain or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. And a lot of times you can't tell immediately. I think in that case, it would be good to reach out. They can reach out to us. We have a pollution hotline that they can contact or call or go onto our webpage and enter a record of something that they may have witnessed so that we can follow up on it. And by the way, our webpage is PugetSoundKeeper.org if anyone's interested. And then you can go in there and report pollution. Just put a enter a location and what was observed, and we will then follow up on it. They can also call 1-800-OILS-911 or 1-800-424-8802. So that's our pollution hotline that they can call and let us know if they're seeing something. I mean, part of our goal when we're doing both our boat patrols and our kayak patrols is to try and educate folks and also train them on what some of the key indicators are. Some of those are really obvious, like sheens on the water, an indication of, you know, potential oil or other petroleum products on the surface of the water. Sometimes it's an odor, like you can smell something that might be coming from a discharge pipe. You may not see it initially, but odor is a very strong indicator of potential chemicals coming into the water. So those are things that we train volunteers on. And if people are interested in learning more, they can also sign up for those kayak patrols and become a little more educated about things to look for.
Okay, well, that's awesome. And I will have all that contact information that you mentioned on our website. Our website being, I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby, and we have a local website that we'll put all that contact information on. So anybody listening to the show who would like to contact Puget Sound Keepers Alliance, and you didn't get a chance to write the stuff down, it's going to be on the net for you. So let's, I've mentioned that we're particularly interested in climate on this show, and I know that climate change has been leading to acidification of Puget Sound. Are you guys monitoring that, or is that a concern, or what?
It's obviously something that's of great concern to us. We're not actively monitoring for increasing acidification in Puget Sound. There are a lot of state and research entities at, like University of Washington that do that type of monitoring. But it's something that we're certainly keeping an eye on from the standpoint of ecological health of Puget Sound, because as we all know, increasing ocean acidification can have some really significant impacts on some of our marine species, just particularly invertebrates, any type of shellfish like oysters or crabs that have a calcareous skeleton that has to form under optimal conditions. And if the ocean is too acidic, especially for the very young, what we refer to as larval stages of some of these crustaceans, they may not be able to form their shells fully, and that eventually leads to mortality. So increasing ocean acidification is of great concern. Puget Sound has a very serious problem with ocean acidification, but we don't specifically monitor for that. We do monitor for a lot of other things. So some of the things that we're currently engaging our volunteers in include monitoring for microplastics. This is also an emerging threat to water quality and some of the species in Puget Sound and elsewhere around the world. I think this is really a global problem rather than a local problem, but we are monitoring it locally. And what we'll do is take volunteers out to specific locations where we collect water samples in small little jars, take them back to our office, and then actually train the volunteers how to create subsamples from that water sample, and then try to look through a microscope and find the microplastic particles that are in the water. And it's amazing how ubiquitous these microplastic particles are. It's a real eye-opener to see. I mean, if you look at a jar full of water, it looks perfectly clear. You wouldn't know that there are any microplastic particles in there. But when you put them under a dissecting scope, you will find them. And so that's something we're monitoring. And we're feeding that information into the other local and state agencies or organizations that are monitoring this on a broader level. So we're trying to play our part in doing some of the sampling and getting involved in microplastic analysis and education about the potential harms that come with microplastics. Another thing we're doing is we're participating in the Mussel Watch program. This is where we take cages out that have mussels in them and leave them underwater for 30 to 60 days, and then they're retrieved and they're sampled. Their tissues are then sampled for pollutants. And the Mussel Watch program is a nationwide program, and we're involved in that and collecting, both deploying and then collecting the mussel cages with volunteers at certain times of the year when that collection is happening. And then we also do some salmon stream monitoring. One in particular that we've been very focused on is Longfellow Creek. It's one of the smaller creeks feeding into the Duwamish River. And there we've seen cases of pre-spawn mortality, which you have probably heard about. These are when salmon come back to the streams to spawn and never make it to that point because they succumb or die before they're able to spawn. And it's referred to as pre-spawn mortality syndrome. So we have volunteers going out to some of these smaller creeks that are spawning habitat for various salmon species to take counts and see if salmon are returning, but also to really keep a close eye on whether some of those salmon have died before they were able to spawn. And obviously that is of concern to us. We are finding that this is a pretty chronic issue and problem throughout Puget Sound and some of our tributaries. And we think that is a direct result of polluted stormwater runoff coming off of our roadways, highways, bridges, parking lots, where heavy metals and other toxic materials get deposited through cars or just various forms of pollution coming off of rooftops and that sort of thing. When we have rainfall, that goes into a storm drain. That's why you see signs on a lot of storm drains around Puget Sound and elsewhere. A little fish on the storm drain to say, hey, be aware that this whatever might be discharged is going directly into a tributary and into Puget Sound. And to be mindful of not dumping any sort of pollutants into those storm drains, because they may not go through a wastewater treatment plant. They may go straight to a waterway and have really harmful effect on, for instance, salmon that might be attempting to spawn in some of those small creeks and streams.
Yeah, so the salmon population's something that I think we're all concerned about. One of the results of our warming climate, Washington State's warmed a couple degrees Fahrenheit in the last 100 years. Of course, that's impacted glaciers, snowpack, and also it's impacted the water temperature in the tributaries to the Puget Sound, which I would imagine is affecting the health of the fish. Is that something that you guys look at?
Oh, it's something that we're definitely tracking. This is a really complex issue because you have sort of intermingling factors playing a role here. So the obvious and big one is climate change, as you mentioned, having longer, drier, hotter spells throughout the summer, and that resulting in these increasing water temperatures that are potentially even fatal to some species of salmon. It's not just a problem in Puget Sound. It's a problem on some of the other major river systems in our country, including the Snake and the Columbia. especially when it comes to water bodies or rivers that have been dammed and don't have sufficient flows at certain times of the year, and that increases the temperature of the water as well. That can be very inhibitory towards salmon spawning, and in some cases, as I mentioned, it could actually be fatal to salmon if those temperatures remain too high for too long. But the other big factor playing a role here is habitat loss. So, you know, a lot of our streams and rivers used to have trees and vegetation growing to the edge of the river, and that provided shade and refugia, as they refer to it, areas for fish to take refuge that are out of the main stem of the river and might be protected or in the in shaded areas where they can get out of the heat that's caused by, you know, high noon sun beating down on a river. And unfortunately, we've lost a lot of those refugia and habitat areas, natural habitat where fish like salmon used to be able to take refuge and get out of the hotter waters. So that's something that we're also very engaged with in terms of the Department of Ecology, is tracking what buffers are being put in place in terms of protecting and restoring some of the habitat along our streams and rivers.
Yeah, I think I take part of your point there, and that is that climate change is not something that either you or I or the state of Washington really has much ability to control. We do have some ability to control loss of habitat and so on. So we often hear climate change referred to as a threat multiplier, and it kind of seems like that might apply in this particular situation too. So one of the things that I like is sometimes there are what I would call fairly simple, straightforward, understandable data points, understandable by the layperson. So one of those would be returning salmon populations. So what have we seen in the Puget Sound in terms of returning salmon over the last 20, 30 years? What are the trends there?
The trends are obviously going in the wrong direction. So currently, many of our runs are only between 1 and 5% of what they were historically. Three of our five Puget Sound salmon stocks are listed under the Endangered Species Act as threatened. That's the Chinook salmon, obviously, chum salmon, and steelhead trout. So, yeah, I mean, when I mentioned before that the United States really hasn't been a success story in terms of fisheries management, we do have our problems, obviously. And Puget Sound is one of those areas that, you know, we've just had a compounding of different factors, loss of habitat, climate change with increasing water temperatures, and I would imagine fishing has played a role as well. But we've also had increases in some of our marine stocks, like our orca population, not to say our southern residents. They're definitely in trouble because the Chinook salmon populations are in trouble. But other killer whale stocks along the coast of Canada and Alaska are actually doing really well since the Marine Mammal Protection Act went into effect. And so with increasing populations of some marine mammal stocks, like sea lions, seals, and killer whales, that puts increased pressure on some of our salmon stocks. So it's not something people often want to talk about, some of the more challenging, vexing problems when it comes to our own Puget Sound salmon stocks. But there are some wide-ranging issues that are, you know, difficult to tackle. Let's put it that way.
Yep, understood. And I got to just say, as a layperson, the idea of returning salmon stocks being 5% of what they were historically is a pretty horrifying stat. And I certainly hope we can do better going forward. So we are getting close to the end here, Chris. So in terms of things getting better going forward, what do you find around the Puget Sound in terms of our water quality, the tributaries? What do you find that gives you, let's say, hope for a healthier sound going forward?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because you're right. We do often tend to dwell or focus on the negative, me included, because there are a lot of problems, but we are making a lot of good headway. For instance, in stormwater runoff, we've made really significant strides in terms of water treatment and water treatment plants. We've made significant strides in terms of low impact development. So creating bioswales or green spaces where stormwater runoff can first filter through before it goes into either a stormwater drainage system or actually into a river or stream. Having these green areas and low impact development surfaces that are permeable and allow water to soak through, that removes a lot of the pollutant load that's coming off of the parking lots and driveways and highways into our waterways. So we've made some really significant strides there. There's still a lot to be done, but we've made good progress. We're also making progress in terms of just monitoring polluted runoff from different outfalls and trying to take corrective actions to have better treatment facilities in place for some of these facilities to reduce the amount of polluted runoff. So as I mentioned at the outset of our discussion, we have a very active monitoring and enforcement arm in Puget Soundkeeper Alliance. And we've had many, many successful cases where we've taken polluters to court, and the ultimate result was that they installed mitigation systems that reduced that polluted runoff through treatment systems that eliminated some of the heavy toxic metals. And that's a real win, and that's something we'll continue doing and continue educating the public about so that they're aware and these businesses are aware that they can reduce their pollutant load. It might take some additional effort, but it is required under the law, and it's something that they can do. So to me, that's also a positive sign that we're doing what we can to reduce pollution entering Puget Sound. Not to say that we have solved this problem. It is still a very significant problem. But our awareness has increased. People are more and more aware of the importance of trees and green areas to absorb pollutants coming off of impermeable surfaces. And I think there's been a lot of focus at the local level to try and address some of these polluted runoff issues. And that to me is very encouraging, that people are becoming more conversant, more knowledgeable, and more active in trying to help maintain water quality in Puget Sound.
Yeah, you know, I am personally picking up that there's a shift going on in our culture at large, that people are becoming more aware of the environment that we live in, how fragile it can be, and how much we need a healthy environment. So I'd like to just finish up by saying, Chris, I really appreciate everything that you do, the staff up there at Puget Soundkeeper Alliance, and especially the volunteers that obviously they're driven by concerns for passing on a healthy earth to the folks that are going to follow us. So thanks for all you do. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I will say that there are other subjects that I would love to talk to you about, and perhaps we can talk again sometime downstream and I can get to those.
Thanks, John. Thanks for the opportunity to come on your show. And I'd like to thank you for what you do in terms of educating the public about climate issues. I think that's really important. So thank you for your work.
Okay, great. And have a great day. So long.
What a great conversation with Chris. And I am looking forward to talking to Chris further on water quality issues around Puget Sound and the impacts it's having on marine life and so on. The science of climate change can be both simple and it can be complex. Fortunately, we've got scientists, professionals who do the complex part for us. And as I've said in other programs, it's important to make sure we know who we're listening to when we listen to scientists who talk about that complexity. But a lot of the indications of climate change are not complex. They're easy for us as non-scientists to understand. I'm talking about things like glaciers. It's easy for us to see that glaciers are disappearing all over in the Olympics and the Cascades. It's also easy for us to see the impacts of climate change and other human activity on the water quality in the Puget Sound. Short version, we can't keep on doing what we're doing. The sound, as well as the glaciers and other things that we can easily see, are canaries in the coal mine. They're telling us that we're not headed in the right direction and we need to change. So that's it for today. I'd love to hear from you. I can be reached via email at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. That CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. And by the way, If you would like to get the links and other contact information for the Puget Sound Keeper Alliance, those links will be on the Citizens Climate Lobby webpage. You can get to that this way, ccltacoma.org. Look for resources, and there will be a regular posting of things of interest to folks who have listened to this program. So, once again, I'm reminding you, always live like the mountains out. Take care.